giving of the law occurred in the presence of the entire community. Consent of Nasev and Ishmo was indispensable, so that's why they had to congregate at the foot of Mount Sinai. Yet once they sanctioned the covenant, God told Moses, in accordance with the wishes of the people, to tell the people to depart for their homes, and only Moshe should remain with him. Leich emeir lohem, shuvu lochem leo leichem, ve'atopei amei dimori. God does not address himself to the crowd. He speaks to the individual. His relationship is a personal one. There is confrontation between God and each individual person. God communicates his word mainly and foremost to the mind, to the intellect. For God is a teacher who enlightens, educates, and informs. And a teacher, and as a teacher, he prefers the rendezvous with the Yochid, the lone individual, to that of the crowd. It's very hard to teach a crowd. Very hard to lecture to a crowd. I am an experienced lecturer, especially. I have now a class of 115 boys. It's very hard. Of course. The smaller the class, the more the teacher may accomplish. It's very hard. Because when you address yourself to emotions, to emotional man, of course, the bigger the crowd, the easier it is for the speaker, I mean, to put across his message. But if the speaker wants to put across his message, not to the heart, but he addresses himself to the mind, so then he has to speak to each individual separately. The encounter with the individual is very profitable. It conveys information, it instructs and trains, and also redeems and hallows the mind, while the revelation to the crowd elicits mainly an uncritical emotional response, arouses the human heart, but has little to give to the mind. And Yahadus knows nothing about revivalism. You cannot bring anybody to Yahadus by having him participate in a nice ceremony. Yahadus rejects ceremonialism. How much ceremonialism do you have in Yahadus? What do you have? Davening and tefillah is not a ceremony. It's not even a service in the colloquial sense of the word. It is, again, tefillah means to think, to judge, to simply evaluate oneself and so forth. That tzibur, the Yahadis tzibur, can consist just of 10 people. What is tzibur? Of course, it's just of 10. Because Yahadus basically, as a teacher, as an instructor, as a Torah, which wants to enlighten, to inform, and to train, likes to deal with individuals, not with a crowd. Now the question is, what has an individual who lives in the times of Ahasuerus? And as I told you, I believe the two of you live in the same, in similar times. In an age of human, unlimited human ambition, of human aggression, and human self-transcendence, for the attainment of either beauty or authority or rule or complete control over the environment, what has an individual who is contemporary of Ahasuerus and Shargas and Hegoy, and of Mao Zedong, and of the Dera Flog and the Dera Mabul combined, how should such an individual act? What is his duty? And basically, this is the main problem of the Jewish religious community. I'm not speaking about other religions, about the Jewish religious community. After all, we reject both. We reject, I mean, orgiastic men, we reject authoritarian men. Actually, Yahadus believes in equality, full-fledged equality. I mean, and Yahadus believes that man is limited, can never transcend himself. If he will succeed in transcending himself, he will finally perish. We are on the brink, basically, of catastrophe, of disaster. How should this individual act? It's only individual among many. Or even the group is a minority. How should it react? How should it respond to such times? I believe the answer is given in Megillas Esther. After Megillas Esther has portrayed permissive, orgiastic, pleasure-conscious, hedonia-addicted society, and after Megillas Esther has portrayed tyranny of Haman, idolization of man, because he wanted everybody to prostrate himself, self-idolization of man, man setting himself up as an idol. So, in contrast with the Ahasuerus society, which leads to Haman political tyranny and complete enslavement, Yahadus, the Megillah, gives actually, I mean, tries to portray Esther and Mordechai Yehudi. What did Esther and Mordechai Yehudi do? And particularly, how did Mordechai react to that society? A very strange psukim in the Megillah. Leigido Esther esamo ves meladeto. כי מרדכי ציבו עליה שלא יסגת. ובכל יום ויום מרדכי ניסה לך לפני חצר בית אנשים, לא דעת אשלים אסתר מה היא עושה לו. ביומים ההם, ומרדכי ישב בשער המלך, ובקובץ פסולי שניס, ומרדכי ישב בשער המלך, ומרדכי יודע אסכולה שנה הזאת. Just a conglomeration of fragments. Prima facie, we do not understand Mordechai. What was the reason for Mordechai's inseparability from Esther? He walked every day during her stay in the court of the woman's house, past that house every day. Uvacholim yemzat mean only once a day, apparently 10 times a day. Even after she had been taken away and chosen queen of Persia, he continued to stay at the gate of the king. Why? What for? What attracted Mordechai that he somehow could not depart from the gate of the king? Walking back and forth, up and down, past the gate, listening, trying to overhear, observing, watching, studying, what was it? He knew what happened. He knew Ahasuerus pretty well. He did not expect Ahasuerus would release Esther. It was almost an impossibility, you see. Why didn't he leave the grounds? Mordechai Yeshu B'Shar HaMelech. According to Chazal, the way they described Mordechai, was a member of the Sanhedrin. He had more important affairs at hand. Why didn't he return home? Then resume, his duties and daily chores. Of course, we would like to understand also, why did he enjoin Esther from revealing her identity? There was some reason. I believe, you can understand the Megillah if you read between the lines. The answer which you find between the lines, in the small print, invisible print, is that somehow a mood of tense expectancy of concentrated anticipation permeated Mordechai. And if you read the whole story, it is this mood of tenseness, of anticipation, of foreboding, of waiting for events to happen, not knowing what kind of events, pervades the whole background. Mordechai did not apparently look upon the coercive removal of Esther from his home and her ascent to the queenship of Persia as a trivial episode. He did not consider it. It was not trivial to him. He could have interpreted it in very simple terms. Ahasuerus is out for a beautiful wife. I mean, Esther was beautiful, good-looking, even though Chazal tried to give a different portrait, say she was a bit greenish. Yes. Okay. But however, I mean, he could have interpreted. If this had happened to someone else, he would have interpreted it rationally, practically, in a business-like manner. I mean. Now, apparently, Mordechai was not a businessman. His mind was not guided by commercial logic. He saw in that event that Esther, a Jewish girl, the daughter of an immigrant, of one who was exiled from, that's why the Megillah tells us about the origin of Esther. She was apparently a daughter, an orphan, the daughter of one who was exiled, an immigrant, a refugee, should become the queen of Persia. This cannot be explained in simple terms. It requires elucidation and more profound understanding. He did not consider her ascent to the throne in Persia as a trivial episode whose significance is confined to the individual. He intuitively discovered in that and in many other accompanying occurrences and events the fingerprints of the maker of history. We believe that there is a maker of history. History is not made by itself. Someone who directs the destiny of history draws the fingerprints. The fingerprints of the maker of history, planning, preparing, and setting the stage for a great, breathtaking drama to be unfolded. Of course, Mordechai did not know exactly who will act in that drama, who the ensemble of the drama will be, and who will be the central figure, and in general, what the finale of the drama will be. However, he felt that history is in making, that something is about to burst forth with elemental vigor, that fate and destiny of somebody, and he didn't know yet whose fate and destiny, of an individual or a people, who will be determined. A drama is being written, the stage being set, someone will have to act. What will happen? Will it be a comedy or a tragedy? What will be the finale of the drama? He didn't know. But he felt something is incoming. Even he also believed, and of course Mordechai also believed, this is what we call alertness to history, sensitivity to events. Some people are dull to historical events. Our parents came here, parents, grandparents, came here. If they had understood history well, if they had been alert to historical events, to historical, so to say, flux, then unfolding, they wouldn't have lost two generations. If they just changed it, their approach to chinuch, to education of their children, we could have the greatest and the most beautiful Jewish community that has ever existed. But they were not alert like Mordechai to history. Each event they considered the usual. And Mordechai not only was alert to history, he was full of expectancy. He was sensitive. He had historical perception. He also believed in something else. And that's very important. That since history is the story of man, history is not the story of the astral world, it's the story of the human world. The latter can and has a right and is duty-bound to intervene in historical unfolding and direct events toward objectives he cherishes. Man, and this is the opinion of Yahadus, man is free. And this freedom is a part of his greater freedom, which was granted to him by his Maker. He is free to play an important part in the shaping of the historical drama. He can change events, he can channel events toward different objectives. And Mordechai believed, if man is duty-bound to intervene in historical process, and man is capable of leaving an imprint upon historical unfolding, so men must not miss the opportunity. And the opportunity is almost infinitesimal. God knocks on the door of the human being who wants in his life. That's the Chachmei Kabbalah. You know the story of Shir HaShirim. When Shulamite, very funny girl. Sometimes she's so paradoxical that I don't understand her. I lose patience with her. I mean, she's out to find her beloved. Correct? Daddy, on all her daddy. Keeps on searching him. A day, at night, time, I mean. And exposes himself to injury and to humiliation and to abuse. Motsuni Hashem Rimaseim Buir, Ikunif Tzouni. And days and nights she's questing and she's for her beloved, searching him. And once apparently she came late, tired, exhausted, after a day-long search, and she had to, and she was exposed to abuse, and she felt tired, and she retired. It was a dark night, dreary night, a bleak night. And suddenly, she heard a knock on the door. Who is there? Who is it? Who is knocking on the door? Pischeli, Achesi, Rayosi, Inesi, Tamosi, please open the door to me. My sister, my dove, my beloved, Shereshi Nimlotol, Kvotsei Sarisis, Eloilo. My head is full of dew. I am tired. And what was she supposed to do? After all, she's been searching him for so long. He knocks on the door. Now the opportunity came. The happy hour struck. Open the door and take him in. No, now she was lazy. She already got undressed. She cannot dress. I mean, she washed her feet. She don't want, to touch the ground. Anyway, he knocked once, twice, three times, four times, five times. Finally, he stopped knocking. When he stopped knocking, she jumped out. She jumped off her bed. Open the door, come in. But by the time she opened the door, he was gone. Many people, play the same role vis-a-vis history. They want something, they search for something, they quest for something. And when this something, this objective, when God knocks on their door, then somehow they are gripped by lethargy. and certain paradoxical mad laziness and inertia, and they missed the opportunity. And that's what Mordechai did not want to miss. And that is why Mordechai was sitting at the gate of the king. And that's why Mordechai was walking past the house of the women. And that's why Mordechai was trying to overhear every bit of conversation. Mordechai wanted to be informed, because events might take place quickly, unexpectedly, and he must not miss the opportunity. Of course, this is important for every nation, to have a certain sixth sense of history, historical sense, historical perception. A great statesman means who anticipates events, more or less, who understands events, somehow whose hand is on the pulse of history. Yeah. This is basically, for us Jews, for instance, I'll give an example. A lack of historical sensibility and alertness actually resulted in the Versailles Treaty. If the people who wrote the treaty, among them great statesmen, Wilson, Lloyd George, Clemenceau, Frenchmen, great statesmen, statesmen of international renown, if they had written a different treaty, no Hitler would have emerged in the historical arena, and 20 million lives could have been saved. Whoever crossed the corridor, they divided Germany into two parts at that time. They separated East Prussia from Western Germany. The way it's separated now, but the map was different. Whoever crossed this corridor, when the Germans in the train, had to lock their doors, because suddenly a Polish officer used to appear, so knew and could feel that the Second War is in the offing. It was impossible. The Versailles Treaty is responsible for the Second World War. And the Yalta Treaty, which our great Roosevelt actually gave his blessings to, the Yalta Treaty will be responsible, I hope not, but for the Third War. If not for the Yalta Treaty, there would be no problem about Berlin. There would not be no problem about Czechoslovakia. If not for the Yalta Treaty, after all, America won the war and surrendered the spoils to Russia. See, basically what the Yalta Treaty accomplished. It's a lack of alertness, of understanding of history, of clairvoyance, of vision. That's what Mordechai had, and the great statesmen of the 20th century did not have. Of course, for the Jewish people, his responsiveness, alertness, openness to the fine movements of history is almost a conditio sine qua non for their survival, because we are a persecuted people, and still persistent and proud. Jewish people is a very proud one. Sometimes I used to doubt about American Jew, whether he's a proud Jew. But now, studying the American Jew, observing his relationship to Eretz Israel, to the state of Israel, I find a lot of pride and a lot of loyalty in the American Jew. Because basically, it's inconvenient for us. Because many times we have to speak against our own government. And people, go and say, the Jew has divided his loyalties or his allegiance between Israel and the United States, And all right, we reject it. But a goy, does not reject it. Yet. But American Jew displays now a lot of pride, courage, and bravery, as a matter of fact. We are a proud people. With a unique way of life, with an eschatology of our own, which encompasses not only the entire mankind, but also the whole universe, a people who is disliked by many and misunderstood by all. A people who has brooded long and patiently on man and his destiny. Such a people, in order to survive, must be history conscious. If he lacks the sense, the sixth sense, or his sensitivity to history, his alertness and openness to history, the Jew cannot survive. I spoke before about our parents and grandparents. What did they lack? The sixth sense. They thought that the Jew, they didn't want their children to be assimilated. No, they didn't want them. I knew many of them. When I came to Boston, right? I found the parents and the grandparents, matter of fact, were members of our Chevreshas. Yes. But they did not want the children to become assimilated or to sever their bond with our past. They thought it can be accomplished without teaching the children. And this is this means lack of historical sensitivity and historical intelligence. For instance, I'll give you an example. The state of Israel was born not because history suddenly presented a surprise people with a grant or with a gift. No. The people heard a summons, basically. The people heard a summons, which was issued by Providence. They rose and have actively become involved in the channeling of historical forces toward a distinctive objective. I mean, it means toward the formation of the State of Israel. The state could not have come into existence several years before 1948. It certainly could not have come in existence a couple of years later. For a simple reason. Few years before 1948, there was no United Nations. You needed the United Nations. I say Chazal speak about a rain which is just meant for one blade of grass. I believe the whole United Nations, what it has accomplished, I don't know. But the whole United Nations was organized, created for one purpose only, for the formation of the State of Israel. Without the United Nations would have been an impossibility. Because the United Nations has lent legitimacy and status to the State of Israel, you see. Of course. So this is 1948. The United Nations was, organized 1946, 1947. But in 1948, we did not have the African. But the whole United Nations was organized, created for one purpose only, for the formation of the State of Israel. Without the United Nations would have been an impossibility. Because the United Nations has lent legitimacy and status to the State of Israel, you see. Of course. So this is 1948. The United Nations was, organized 1946, 1947. But in 1948, we did not have the African nations, the Asian nations. European nations have dominated the scene. And America and the Soviet Russia were not yet at loggerheads. It's the only decision in which America and Russia have concurred. And this means that the Jewish people have not missed the opportunity. Somehow they have the sixth sense, the history. And of course, as I told you, you had to assess that the sixth sense of, or the predictive element or sensitivity to history is indispensable not only for the statesman. You see, the ordinary non-Jew can afford to forget about history. All right, let his statesmen worry. Let Nixon worry about history. I mean, he's worried very much. He keeps on consulting everybody. Yeah. But he has problems. I mean, he can only resolve the problems if he'll develop a sense of openness to history, some alertness to historical events, and more or less clairvoyance for future developments. For the ordinary citizen, there is no need for the ordinary citizen to understand history. He can rely on his government. As far as our people is concerned, the sensitivity to history is indispensable not only for the statesman or ruler, but for the ordinary Jew, for the everyday individual. Because everyday individual is responsible for Jewish survival. First of all, we have no rulers, we have no statesmen. I mean, as far as the Jewish community all over the world, I'm not speaking about a political community, this is the state of Israel. I'm speaking about the Jews forming in the spiritual community. We have no rulers, we have no heads, we have no presidents, we should formulate policies and make decisions on our behalf. Every individual makes his own decision, and this is exactly what I said before, that Yehadus was concerned with. Yehadus did not deal with the crowd, Yehadus dealt with every individual separately. And every individual is responsible for his understanding and alertness to history. In particular, when I speak about history, I mean the problem of chinuch, education. If a father understands that his first duty is to hand down the spiritual treasures which he received from his father to his son. So he must also understand that in order to be able to hand it down to his son, to pass it on, he must train his son. That he should be able to receive and to be a guardian of that treasure. Many parents have no historical sense for that. Some have. And those who have, I mean, are fortunate. And this ties in with the Judaic philosophy. I mentioned once in my shiurim here that every man, every individual, is a shliach of God. The Rambam speaks about shliach okeinu. Every individual is a messenger or an agent of God. Or I may say, or malach elokim. We are accustomed to assume that whenever the Bible speaks of malach, it refers to some transcendental being, or to use the medieval language of the scholars, a separate intelligence. This is not always true. Quite often the Bible employs the term malach signifying a human being. You know a pasuk of that? The malach. Yaakov said, when God sent the malach. I'm not speaking about Yaakov. A prophet is also called malach elokim, the messenger or the agent of God. Vanitzak al Hashem, vayishma askalenu, vayishlach malach, vayitzenu mitzrayim. So Rashi says, malach zemeshe. This is Moses. In other words, that each one of us was assigned a task. Man is not born just into the world. Man, when he is sent into this world, is charged with a task. He is given an assignment. He carries a burden. He has to discharge a mission. And the duty of man is to fulfill his mission which he was given. Of course, this comes, to expression, particularly in Mordechai's message to Esther. רווח ועצור ימיד ליהודים מוקים אחר, ויעטו בסביך תבדו, ומי ידע אם לאיס כזייס יגעת למלכוס. Basically, what is Mordechai conveyed after? I believe one, two, three thoughts. What did he convey to Esther? First, every individual has an assignment. He must implement, which he must implement. There was no excuse, there was no apology. Esther, according to Mordechai, was born into this world, endowed with beauty and charm for one purpose only, in order to help her people. Her action now, her behavior now will justify and legitimize actually her existence. Otherwise, if she refused to help her people, her existence is an illegitimate one. Second, if the individual refuses to implement the assignment, many individuals refuse, so God's will will be done anyway. Even though the individual appointed as agent to act on his behalf or on the behalf of the Almighty did not actually discharge his duty and betray the trust which the Almighty had in him. This is the second thought. The third thought is the person who failed forfeited his legitimate ontological rights. His life is shambles and worthless. And at this juncture, when Mordechai, as the individual, speaks of the assignment given to each one of us, in particular to a person who is in a position of power and can help, the biblical woman appears on the stage. This is Esther. What is the main trait of this woman? What is she actually? What singles her out and assigns to her a unique place? I believe that the answer is given in the book. First of all, Yahadus did not believe that the differentiation between male and female, and there is a differentiation between male and female, which expresses itself not only biologically but spiritually as well, Yahadus did not believe that this differentiation consists in contradiction. Yahadus believe that differentiation consists in complementarity. Not in conflict, but in cooperation. Not in tension and hate, but in harmonious correspondence. Many things Yahadus believed men can accomplish. A lot of things Yahadus believed only the woman can accomplish. The assignments differ, the metaphysical assignments, the shliches, the malachut, differ. However, God's will is implemented by both, not by one of them. Men alone could not do the job. The woman alone could not succeed. Behind every Moses, there is a Miriam. Where would have Moses been if Miriam had not watched him as a baby when he was cast into the river Nile? Behind every Abraham is a Sarah, and behind every Mordecai is an Esther. Providence assigns to each one a task which fits his or her metaphysical nature and character. It's very hard to guess. Yahadus did not know of the Amazon myth. You know the Amazon myth,
the warrior-like women, the masculine women, who defeated men, which was so popular among the ancient Greeks. Because the others did not believe that the woman confronts man. We cannot understand, basically, Yehadus cannot understand, you do not understand, but Yehadus recorded it in order, I mean, to point out the distinction between our viewpoint and the viewpoint of Memuchan. We don't understand Memuchan's fear and the fear which gripped the other aristocrats and the princess of Ahasuerus, that the Vashti incident should not trigger a war of the sexes. I mean, Leila Melach Levadu of Vashti Amalko. Insurrection on the part of the female against the male. This was Memuchan's argument. Neither do we accept the modern theories, and it's not only Memuchan's appear. The modern theories, call it psychoanalytical theories or psychological theories. I don't care what you call it. They are wrong of it. Anyway, the modern theories of conflict and tension bordering sometimes on hatred between father and mother, men and women, in which the child gets involved. All these views, you know, the Greek myth of the Amazons, Memuchan's fear that the woman will take over, and everybody will have to speak the language of the woman. And the modern theories of tension and conflict and hate and complexes. Mother complex and father complex and so forth on is just due to one premise. All these views are characteristic of a hedonic, pleasure-addicted society where the woman is looked upon as an object of beauty, the way Ahasuerus considered, to be enjoyed. The command of Ahasuerus to appear to Vashti, to appear before foreign princess and nobleman in order they all should enjoy her good looks, demonstrates the shameful approach to the woman. In such a society, there must be tension. For conflict is built into the very texture of sex relationship, which is just nurtured by passion and lust. Conflict is built in. And basically, I'm not a marriage counselor, you know that very well. So I know very little about divorces, but more or less. Basically, therefore, there is in the modern matrimonial union, there is no genuine equality. It's either the husband or the wife rules dominates. Either the husband is afraid of the wife, or the wife is afraid of the husband. If the wife controls 51% of the shares, he married a rich girl, so she plays the first fiddle. If the husband is a rich man, and he married a poor girl, so then he is the boss. But there is no cooperation, the full sense of the word. Anyway, I can't tell you, I cannot be too sure, I have never come across that. There is always a victor and a defeated party. Yes. Whether it is obvious to everybody or it's hidden, the facade is beautiful, facade is dearly and lovely, you understand? Matters not. Because where Adonai rules, the woman is looked upon as an object of Adonai, of pleasure. And conflict is built into the very sex relationship, if passion rules. However, if both men and women are commissioned by the Almighty to implement an assignment, to fulfill a task, small or great, if both are messengers and agents of God, to whom, through whom, rather, His will is realized, then there cannot be any conflict. because their assignments complete each other. Their complementarity and harmony are the intrinsic traits of the relationship. And basically, I mean, I'm not trying, so to say, to idealize the Jewish family of old, but I know a little about it. There was no conflict in the Jewish family of old. When I say conflict, I don't mean loud quarrel. No, I don't mean, you throw dishes at each other. Or husband beating up the wife, or the wife beating up the husband. But I mean complementarity, harmony, and cooperation in a spiritual sense. Because both mother and father had a task. And basically the objective of the assignment was the child. Mother used to do her part. I know how my mother brought me up and how my father brought me up. There was no conflict. They complemented each other. There was harmonious relationship. There, if the philosophy of marriage is assignment, there is no need for a royal decree regulating the language which should be spoken in the house. Memucha recommended that language be that of man, of the husband. However, and I'm finishing here, Mordechai, even though he was sensitive to history and possessed the predictive element, did not know, basically, how to bring about salvation. How simply to bring to naught Haman's conspiracy. He didn't know. He knew that we have got to do something, but he didn't know how. He just instructed Esther. What did he tell Esther? Yodi al melech yischanilei ulevakish milfonov al amo. But he did not suggest any plan how to upset Haman's plan or pernicious conspiracy. How to go about it? Had Esther listened to Mordechai? Had Esther listened to him? And had she immediately, upon her appearance in the inner court, after having touched the scepter, knelt before the throne of Ahasuerus and began to implore the king for mercy and change of heart, her mission would have failed completely. And both she and her people would have perished. Only Esther's foresight, here you needed a woman. Mordechai could not accomplish the task alone. Only her foresight, cunning, practical wisdom, and thorough knowledge of Ahasuerus, his changing moods, his idiosyncrasies, his irritability, his flare-ups, his quick decisions reached upon the spur of the moment, saved her and the Jewish community from death. The clarion call, the summons to act, the warning that Esther has been charged at birth with a great assignment to be fulfilled many years later, came from Mordechai. The plan to play cool and to wind the king with Haman to a banquet and to delay the confession until the second day was laid out not by Mordechai, but by Esther. And Esther somehow had also that sixth sense. She also expected something to happen between the first day and the second day. And something indeed did happen between the first day and the second day. Something which was the turning point in the whole story. You know what I am referring to? The sleepless night of Ahasuerus. בלילה הוא נודד השנס המלך. Two kings did not sleep. Achashverosh downstairs, so he wouldn't care about it so much. And the Melech Malchei Amlochim upstairs. And since the Melech Malchei Amlochim upstairs did not sleep, so history changed its course. Belaila hu dodeto shnas ha-melech hazal say, shnas malki shalelon, the king of the universe. After this comical performance, the whole story of Nodesh Nas ha-melech is very comical. It's comedy, basically. After that comedy, Haman's doom was sealed, and Esther had a relatively easy job to perform. The architect of the Nespurim, of the great miraculous events, Mordechai was. The seer, prophet, and the conscience of Esther. He was the conscience of Esther. She, in turn, was the real Malach, who conceived the plan and executed it. Without Mordecai, Esther would have been caught unawares. Without Esther, Mordecai's alarm and despair and loud crying and imploring and protestations would have been an exercise in futility. None was indispensable. They complemented each other and they worked together harmoniously. And as it always happens to the biblical woman, her life was sacrificed in order to fulfill the mission. Man fulfills a mission and does not sacrifice his life. The woman, when she fulfills her mission, her life is sacrificed. Esther, Mordechai did not offer much, did not sacrifice much. Esther, everything she had. Her sense of dignity, to be taken away to Achashverosh, I mean, it was a very dignified affair. Or to be a queen of Achashverosh was not so wonderful either, because Achashverosh was searching for another queen who will be covered its psule shenis. Perhaps he'll find a fairer woman, so he'll replace Esther with a new girl. She had sacrificed her sense of dignity, her sanctity, her purity. She was ready to give her whole life. Because this appearance in the courtyard of Achashverosh, she took an awful chance with her appearance. Her role was hallowed by a sacrificial action, self-denial and self-effacement. No wonder that the scroll is called not Megillas Mordechai, but Megillas Esther. יזגדל ויזקדש מרבו ויעלמוד עברו כירוסי וימליך מלכוסי וחייכון וימיכון וחיי דכל בייס ישראל והגולו וזמן קוראים אמרו אמי יש מרבו מבורך לעולם ולעולמי עולמיו יזברך וישתבח ויזכוח ויזרמם ויזנשא ויסהדר ויסהלה שמי לקודש ובריחו לאלו מנקור בחוסו ושיר עשו תוש בחוסו ונחם עשו ואמירון ואומו ואמרו אמן על ישראל ועל רבנון ועל תלמידיון ועל כל תלמידי סלמידיון והכל מונדוסקים ברייס ודיבס רועדין וחלסה ועשה ילהון ולכון שלום הרבו חינו וחסדו ורחמין וחיין עריכין וזנו לבחי ופוקנו וקנו עבורן ובשמיו ואמרו אמן יש לנו רעיון משמעיו, חיים תגמו עלינו ועקו ישראל, אמרו אמן. ואיזה שולם רמו, וישרום עלינו ועקו ישראל, אמרו אמן.